People have often asked how Flannery O'Connor, a nice religious Southern girl, came to write such perverse stories. Brad Gooch was on our show earlier this year to discuss Flannery, A Life of Flannery O'Connor, his new biography of the writer, and we thought that we would rebroadcast that conversation on this Memorial Day. I started out by asking Mr. Gooch if it was difficult to write a biography about an extremely private woman who died at a very young age.
Well, she did claim that no biographies of her would be written because life lived between the porch and the chicken yard did not make exciting copy. But I began to look at that as more of a backhanded invitation or coy after a while. I think that she actually had a pretty richly layered life, and she is a riddle to us and fascinating, so there's plenty there.
So she discouraged people being interested in her personal life. I remember reading that she gave, I think, one radio interview and or a television interview, and refused to talk at all about her personal life.
Yes, that's a painful one to watch. It was called Galley Pages. It was when her first book came out, and it was early talk television. And she basically, the announcer said, "Would you paraphrase for us your story?" And she said, "Well, absolutely not. I think that every word of the story is important." So from there on, it just went downhill.
She once said, "I think you probably," because she did talk about herself, "I think you probably collect most of your experience as a child and then transfer it to other situations when you write." How much did she use her childhood material for her books?
Well, certainly the stories, I mean, almost have a young adult quality to them, I think. And I mean, a lot of violence and religion, but there are a lot of young characters. She doesn't write so much about sex and romance in that way.
Because she didn't seem to have much experience along those lines.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so she does, I mean, in that way, she uses childhood. She never is a memoirist, and she doesn't have pictures from her life in Savannah as a girl. But definitely that point of view, I think. Also, she at one time said that she didn't want to get older than 12 years old. And when she saw anything with the word teen attached to it, she found it repulsive. So she had her own intact sensibility early on.
Well, in looking over the work, did you find autobiographical things?
I absolutely did. I mean, surprisingly, there were a lot of inside jokes. Her mother appears in many stories, is often killed off in these stories. A kind of sketch of her mother is Mrs. May in Greenleaf, who's gored by the bull. And her friend Mariette Lee said to her, "You should be brought up on charges of matricide." What does she think when she sees them? And Flannery said, "Oh, she don't read none of them." So she was constantly, she used the Milledgeville phone book for names of her characters, like Tom T. Shiflett. So she had a lot of gossip in her work.
Where was she born?
She was born in Savannah in 1925 and lived on Lafayette Square. She was an only child in a kind of Catholic community within the Protestant South.
And you say that she never really wanted to grow up. How did other children react to her when she was a kid?
Well, they reacted to her the way people reacted when she was an adult. I mean, she was marvelously intact as a little girl. And she would, for instance, she went to a Catholic school across the street and was required to go to children's mass on Sundays. And she refused. Every Monday morning, the nun would make her stand up at the blackboard and explain why she hadn't gone. And she said, "The Catholic Church does not dictate to my family when we go to mass." And then I interviewed someone who had been in that class at 6 years old, and she said, "I knew then that Mary Flannery wasn't like the rest of us."
And her name was Mary Flannery O'Connor.
Right.
But she chose Flannery because Mary O'Connor just did not sound distinctive enough.
Right. Well, she said, who would buy the, the stories of an Irish washerwoman, I think was her. She changed her name when she went to Iowa City, to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And Flannery, first she wanted to get rid of Mary Flannery, which sounded too Southern. And also Flannery worked for her because it was a gender-neutral name, I think.
The stereotype of her, the one that I had until I read this book, was of an eccentric recluse. And you get the feeling that the kids who she went to school with thought of her as eccentric as well, or strange at least.
No, always. I mean, that she went to her freshman party at the mansion of the president wearing sneakers and a ball gown. So she was always that way. But mainly the younger people thought of her as a cartoonist. She was a cartoonist all through college. She made linoleum cut cartoons every 2 weeks. And these were really these one-frame satires where she made fun of all the professors and all the students and all the events going on around her.
How old was she when her father developed lupus?
She was 15, and she watched him die, and it happened very quickly. She then developed lupus herself later.
Did she suspect? was the genetic component of lupus known at that time?
It wasn't known. It's still a little dubious. I talked to a doctor who was advising me on the medical aspects of this book early on, and I was explaining, well, I'm doing a book about Flannery O'Connor, and she was a writer, and he said, well, no, she's famous in my field. And I said, why? He said, well, her father had lupus, and it's actually unusual that you have a father-daughter connection. So it points to genetics, but they still don't know.
And usually lupus afflicts women, not men.
Usually women, more African-American women. So there was an odd pattern, but not singular.
Did she know that her father was ill?
She knew that he was ill, but it was kept from her. I mean, there was this sort of denial and hush around everything. And then this happened when she developed lupus as well, that her mother didn't really tell her that she was what she had and told her that she had rheumatoid arthritis. So there was a don't ask, don't tell quality about lupus and disease.
How important had her father been to her development?
Oh, completely important. I mean, her father was, unlike her mother's, completely doting, that he would bind her books. I mean, at an early age, she was both drawing and writing. So she would draw ducks and then write a story about a family of ducks traveling around the world, and he would make these into little books for her.
She seems to have been rather competitive with other Southern writers. What distinguishes her writing from Carson McCullough's, Truman Capote, Eudora Welty?
Right. She was definitely mean about Truman Capote and Carson McCullough's and Tennessee Williams. She was anxious about Faulkner because she'd read everything that he wrote and was in awe of him a little bit. But she had it. She said her own one-cylinder syntax. I mean, she had a way of writing that was very paratactic and frontal, and she had ingredients like Roman Catholicism in it. So it is always her story, and her voice is very recognizable, I think.
Also, it strikes me almost a sense of Greek tragedy. She could take, just some ordinary person, and the next thing you know, you're in something that Sophocles would have understood.
Right. Actually, Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk at the end of her life, when she died, wrote that when he thought of her, he doesn't think of Catherine and Porter. Hemingway thinks of Sophocles. So she had this universal, stark quality to her work.
So did she not like Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams because they were gay?
I think because they used sexuality in their work overtly, and I think because they were flamboyant in their life. But she didn't like any of those qualities. She liked Eudora Welty, who was similar to her, lived with her mother, wore black dresses, and maintained the guise of a proper Southern lady.
And Carson McCullers, again, too much sexuality?
Well, those two, they lived 50 miles away from each other, and they disliked each other. Carson McCullers claimed that O'Connor had gone to the school of her, meaning that had stolen her style from her.
I don't think anybody would say that today.
No. I mean, it's interesting that O'Connor has endured in a certain way, and McCullers and some of those other writers less so.
She also didn't like Emily Dickinson.
Right.
Why? I mean, yeah. Dickinson's a pretty great poet.
Yeah, I mean,
and she was friends with Elizabeth Bishop, wasn't she?
Yes, well, they were epistolary friends through Robert Lowell. I think that she was also contrary. I mean, O'Connor's opinions could reverse on people. I mean, so she would often, she liked shock, as in her stories, so she liked the shock value of saying Elizabeth, or that Emily Dickinson poems are like Alka-Seltzer or something. But
well, it's obvious that she wanted things to have real power, and maybe that's the reason she didn't like Harper Lee.
Well, yes, she said To Kill a Mockingbird is a good children's book. She had amazing one-liners.
My guest is Brad Gooch, whose latest biography is of Flannery O'Connor, and it is published by Little Brown. There's a great story in your book about how she reacted when she had to take a dull social science class in college.
Right. Well, she actually took social science because she was trying to avoid an English teacher she didn't like, who disliked her work. So she then took sociology classes and then was annoyed that about saying that you had to count the number of whiskers on a pig or something like that and slam her textbook. So she was very snide about sociology in general.
Her college classmates must have thought she was odd as well.
They all did, but I talked to somehow 50 of them. I mean, I either talked to them or received letters from them, so it was amazing to me, the response and also the vivid memories of her.
She lived in New York, and she went to Iowa after college and was in the famous writing program there.
Yes, she went to Iowa to be a political cartoonist. She applied in the journalism school and then discovered that the great game in town was Paul Engel's writing workshop, which was the first MFA program. And she somehow got herself into that program and really found herself as a writer there. But it did seem that she was trying to escape, I think. I mean, that she was headed towards a life as a, like Truman Capote, a kind of transplanted Southern writer in the cosmopolitan New York City area.
How did she introduce herself to the head of the writing program?
Well, that was very funny. Paul Engel recalls that she walked in and that asked to be admitted to the program and that her Georgia accent was so thick that Midwestern Paul Engel couldn't understand it, so he pushed a pad of paper over to her and asked her to write down what she was saying, and she wrote, "I am Flannery O'Connor, I am a writer, can I come to the writer's workshop?" Semester had already begun, and he said, "We need to see stories," and he said out of the most battered handbag he'd ever seen, she, you know, brought out some stories and that he loved them, and then she joined the program.
I guess she was not for all tastes, and that was part of the problem. Some people recognized genius in her work, and others just didn't get it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Robert Giroux told me that he knew the minute she walked into his office and talked to her without seeing anything that she'd written that she was a great writer, just because of her kind of determination in a certain sense and the way that she spoke and thought.
That's the editor, Robert Giroux.
Right.
Of Strauss and Giroux.
Right, and he became her editor and publisher from that point on. But she was greatly misunderstood, and early on with her first novel, Wise Blood, received some brutal criticism. People couldn't tell if it was a joke or if it was serious. No one picked up on this kind of Christianity between the lines that she was trying to get at.
Many people prefer her short stories to her novels. How do you rank Wise Blood and The Violent Bear It Away?
Well, she, I think, preferred her short stories to her novels. That these novels, she worked on them for 7 years, and then writing stories for her was almost like a vacation, and you know, and they were great.
And she packed so much power in them. A few of them have become literary classics, like A Good Man Is Hard to Find and Everything That Rises Must Converge. There are a number of others that are constantly anthologized.
Right. I mean, she treated fiction as an extreme sport, I think. I mean, these characters, like the Bible salesman who steals the wooden leg of Holga in a hayloft, you can't forget them once you've read them.
Or the story of a family that's going on a trip and suddenly finds himself in one of the most frightening situations you can imagine.
Yes, murdered in the woods by the misfit, who's actually an ex-con that she found in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, clipped out the picture and then turned him into this murderer who spouts existentialist nihilist philosophy. But that story works the way a number of hers do, or maybe all of them, which it starts out as a comedy about a kind of on a family going on a 50s Disney vacation, and then at a certain point turns into this tragedy. And
that's what makes it so much more powerful.
Yeah, you can't tell how to react.
There's a listener asked a question on our show page. Are you aware of the influence that Flannery O'Connor had on Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska album?
Well, he certainly said that it had an influence on him, and so I believe that. But the influence is so varied. Conan O'Brien did his senior paper at Harvard on O'Connor, as did Tommy Lee Jones. So she has an incredible sort of popular culture presence.
You talked about the between-the-lines Catholicism of the writing. Can you read these things without recognizing the religious aspect?
You absolutely can, which again I think is why they're so fascinating. That when Wise Blood novel was published the second time, she added this note at the beginning saying that this was the work of a Christian malgré lui, and her friend Mary Ali, furious, you know, wrote to her and said, "Why did you do this? I mean, you're trying to sort of baptize this work for people." Mary Ali's point always felt that Flannery O'Connor was more like Jekyll and Hyde, that the person who explained the stories and the person who wrote the stories weren't really connected.
And sometimes it's hard to reconcile the perverse nature of some of these stories with a strong sense of religiosity. She also wrote book reviews, many book reviews for Catholic publications.
She did, for the Bulletin, and they're very, you know, A student sort of reviews. I mean, there's something very obedient about O'Connor sometimes. So she was very responsible about writing these reviews. They were mainly of works of theology. And I think partly she did it to get the free copies of all these works that were coming out. So when you see her theological library, it's vast. I mean, it's very impressive.
How did people in her family, like her mother, respond to the stories that she published?
Well, her family, of course, was shocked, and the friends in Milledgeville. So her cousin, Katie Sums, her wealthy cousin, when Wiseblood came out, ordered copies for all of her friends. The friends happened to mostly be priests in the Diocese of Savannah. And then when she actually read the book, she claimed that she went to bed for a week and from this. And her aunt Mary Klein said, I don't know where Mary Flannery finds those people she writes about in her stories, but she certainly didn't meet them here. So she
and she said she did. She met them in the neighborhood and right. In the newspapers.
And she absolutely did. I mean, she took from life so often. Someone was once stopped at the on their way trying to find Andalusia, the farmer. She lived in Milledgeville, and the sister of the priest gave them directions and said, Mary Flannery's a nice girl, but I stay away from her. I'm afraid she'll put me in one of her stories.
A lot of people stayed away from her.
Right.
Many people thought she was attracted to Robert Lowell, but it seems that she had few, if any, romances in her life.
Well, she did with the Eric Langcher, who was a textbook salesman who came to the South and would come on weekends, and they would take rides together, and they kissed at least once. I talked to Eric. He lives in Copenhagen. I've read the letters that she sent to him, and there was definitely a romantic interest there. He then left and became engaged to someone in Denmark. And O'Connor then wrote Good Country People is almost a coded response to this, because the Bible salesman in that work, Eric Langcher, called his catalog of textbooks that he was selling the Bible. So there were, as what I'm saying, inside jokes and revenge and code a little in that story.
Now, Flannery's mother told Robert Giroux that he should try to make her write about nice people.
Right.
Would we even be talking about Flannery O'Connor if he had taken that advice?
No, of course not. But part of her strength was to sit in the middle of this world that didn't understand her and use all of this material and not be crushed by these comments.
You can almost, you can't imagine what it would have been like if she had lived past the age of 39.
You can't imagine that. You can't imagine what it would be like if she lived in the North as she had planned. So a lot of it, the tragedy of her life in the confinement was also a gift.
She would have lived in New York if she could have, but then the lupus sent her back to live with her mother on the family farm.
Right. And she kind of developed a prodigal daughter story out of this, that she'd gone away, but when she came home, she found this sort of hidden gift.
Brad Gooch is the author of a biography of Frank O'Hara, City Poet, now Flannery, A Life of Flannery O'Connor, published by Doubleday.